Well, ring-a-ding-ding, boys and girls. The time has come once again. Another episode of Square One. Coming to you from The Athletic. Coming to you from the Vocal Studios today for all your podcast needs. And if you're doing a podcast, you do need this. Come up here and do your podcast. If you're working around a situation where you don't have the right gear, you don't have this, you don't have that, the thing doesn't sound right, the thing doesn't look right, come up here. Vocal will get it right for you. They are very, very good, very, very reasonable too, you will find. So check them out. Go to vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com. Usually on these things, I prep pretty hard. I make notes throughout the week here and there, just whenever anything pops into mind that I might want to talk to the guest about, just to make sure I don't get caught with my pants down or don't run out of shit or whatever. I didn't do that today because you talk about a next guest needing no introduction. Number one, I've known this cat since the 80s. I worked in the same building, not the same place, but in the same building with him for a good chunk of that. And if you were in the game at all, you know about this guy because he is the big kahuna. He is the number one cop. He is the guy who makes it all happen, and we are delighted to have him today. It is Dale Hansen, no less.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. 40 years. Yeah. It was 40 years. You were working at the zoo, I think they call it then.
Yeah.
And we would see each other at the Rangers games, at that old thing that used to pass as a ballpark, you know? And now you look at where we used to sit and where we used to watch games and where we are now with what that team has become and the stadium they've built and everything. Yeah, we've seen some changes over 40 years. Yeah.
We have seen some changes indeed. And at some point today, I want to get into some of those changes with you because you have never been reluctant to fire off hot sports opinions about TV news and the way TV news works and everything like that. But first, how you doing in all this, man?
The shutdown and the virus and everything. I'm in many ways I'm starting to acclimate myself quite well. I enjoy sitting at home now, and I enjoy doing the sportscast on my patio. I guarantee I do. But I was thinking about this just the other day when you called and said, well, you know, drive up to Addison and let's do this. I haven't been out of the house maybe 10 times since March. I mean, literally, I don't think I've left my house maybe 10 times. I have not worn a pair of shoes in since March. I've worn tennis shoes about 4 or 5 times.
Right.
Because some of those times I left the house, I didn't bother to put on a pair of shoes. I've not had on a pair of dress slacks since March. I'm kind of buying into it in many ways. I miss the poker games with my buddies. I miss just hanging out to some extent, a great deal. And I've done that. I've dipped my toe back into it a little bit. But since I do check off about every box for a bad outcome, if I get COVID-19, I think I'm going to try to be as safe as I can. You know, they start talking about being overweight and health issues and lung. Yeah, check, you know. So I think if I did, ever catch COVID-19, it would probably be a short run for me.
I really see you all masked up over there. So you're taking this pretty seriously.
Yeah, well, I'm a liberal, you know. I mean, it's what us crazy liberals do. But no, I take it very seriously. I mean, I really do. I've had a couple of my buddies come to my patio, and you know, we space out a little bit and drink whatever wine I've got left in the house. And I did play poker with some friends of mine one time. I was a bit uncomfortable. I mean, I really was. I was a bit uncomfortable. Because I also know that most of those guys don't take it seriously. They you know, they're hardcore and they just think it's a hoax. And to this day, some of them still do, which bothers me. And then I joined a couple of guys on the patio at Javier's one night, and we spaced out on their nice patio and drank a little Mexican martini, which is one of my favorite drinks, and that was okay. I mean, I felt okay outdoors on a patio. We're spaced out. That was, I don't do much of anything, and when I do leave the house, I wear the mask. I follow the protocols as best I can.
Yeah.
Silly me. I believe in the science.
So how long has it been since you've actually set foot in the station?
Since the first week of March. They sent us home that first week of March, and I'm not allowed in the station. I started to go back a few months ago. I thought, well, I've got some stuff in my desk. I've got some stuff on a shelf that, you know, I want to just have it at home. And no, we'll have to get somebody to bring it to you if you really need it. WFAA and Tegna, our parent corporation, they have been very, very attentive to the problem. I mean, they've gone full bore to make sure it's as safe as it can possibly be.
Yeah.
And I respect that a great deal. But I'm not even allowed in the station, let alone working in the station. I'm not even allowed to walk in, go up to my desk, and take something out. And the last I heard was about a month ago. They told me that it'll be we'll take another look at it after the first of the year. So I'm thinking about reworking my contract that I get to stay home all the time. I mean, I've got a computer set up where I type up my scripts, and I've got a little camera set up out on my patio, and I sit there and I'm watching TV, and I take 10 steps, sit in my chair, do my sports, and I'm back home, you know, immediately. I kind of like it.
One thing I've wondered about all this is, you know, with things the way they are with business out there these days, if any of these outfits are going to look at this situation of the way people are working at home.
Oh, yeah.
And going,
yeah,
you know what? We could do it this way.
Oh, absolutely.
We don't need big studios. We don't need a big office. We can really downsize the hell out of our operation.
I've got a buddy of mine who's in the commercial real estate business, and that's his biggest single concern, because a lot of companies are already doing that. A friend of mine's a big-time lawyer, and they said their office has already decided, you know, we've got like 8 floors. We don't need that. We need a conference room. We need a receptionist, you know, whatever. Rest of you just stay home.
Yeah.
And in my particular business, I think without question, we can do the job from home, especially if you've got like an anchor, like one anchor in the studio or whatever. But where I think in my particular business the problem is going to be coming is now they're starting to realize, do we really need to send a crew out to Los Angeles to cover the Cowboys game against the Rams? Do we really need to send a crew on the road to Philadelphia to cover the Eagles game? Do we really need to go to spring training with the Rangers? Do we really need to follow these teams? I think it's going to be one of the first things that gets hit hard, because it's expensive. I think we've been protected in the North Texas and certainly the Dallas area because of the great appreciation for, you know, the NBA, Cowboys, Stars, you know. I think we're a bit special in that regard. That local sports has a bigger footprint than it does in many cities. I mean, because it's been written about, you've seen this for years, that, you know, is local sports dead? And in a lot of cities, it is. I mean, I'm talking about the sports anchor, the coverage.
The guys that do what you do.
Yeah, the guys that do what I do. And it has slowly started to die off. My business, even myself, you know, I used to do 4:45 when I came here in 1980. 4 minutes, 45 seconds. Now I do 3:30, but I only do 3 during the rating books when it really counts. And so they already, I'm down to 3:30 on a typical night. Many, many nights they ask me if I could do 2:45, 3 minutes. Even when they cut it to 3 during the so-called rating books, they'll say, can you do 2:30? Can you, you know? So I'm there's a reason I'm the last thing in the show. I mean, there's always been a reason.
And we'll save the best for last. You know?
Well, this was kind of funny. It's funny you mention that because years ago, I started arguing about this. Well, they do a thing now. I don't know if you notice this much or not, but just like last night is a perfect example. The Cowboys game, okay, Dale, you're off the top of the newscast. All right. I hate that, quite honestly. Because believe it or not, I still do believe in the sanctity of news. I believe in news.
Yeah.
And I just don't think a Cowboys game necessarily, although in Dallas it is to some extent, the most newsworthy item that we should be talking about. But then I also don't believe that Pete Delca should be leading with the weather every night. And that's, everybody says we should do weather. So Delca almost every night leads with, hey, it's not going to rain tomorrow. And it's going to be 70 degrees. Really? Thanks for sharing that, Pete. And in other news, the president decided, I'm like, what? Because you're right. I hate a lot of what we do. Point is, though, I'm arguing with my general manager years ago about this. And I said, I'm the last thing in the show, and I get very little time. She goes, yeah, Dale, we do. We save you for the last. We know that people are going to hang around to see what you have to say. So that's why we bury you at the end of the show. And I said, well, if that's really true, then why, when I've got something that you think is really important, you put me on first? And she just went stone silent. I said, why don't you just let me stay at the end of the show and hold those people so that when I do say the Cowboys lost or the Cowboys won or you, and there was no answer for that. I mean,
what happened to the idea of teasing?
Yeah.
Hey, Dale's got something really big on the Cowboys at the end of the show.
Better wait. Now, it's just a game that every station plays. But I do think, and I've never argued this, and I think it's one of the reasons that I've managed to survive as long as I have. And I think you and I might probably even had this discussion back in the good old days, is that, and I told you this when you started the ticket, and I told, if I didn't tell you directly, I told everybody that was around, you can't make money, you can't have a business if you're going to do a talk radio show that's all sports 24/7. And I said it before you even started it. I said, now, if you blend that in, and I didn't have the vision that you did, but I said, I knew, bigger picture, you guys would not succeed if you sat there and went, hey, I think the Rangers are going to trade Rugi Odor. I mean, really? Call in about that. What do you think? Should we trade Rugi Odor and get a
7-8-7-13-10?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, but you mention that, you talk about it. And oh, by the way, did you see that movie? Did you see that gal walking? Whatever it is you crazy guys did for all those years. Oh, now that's a gold mine. Well, I've applied the same thing to sports. And I think you remember this, Mike. When I came in 1980, that was my approach. And Vern Lundquist thought, I'm just an idiot. A lot of people thought, I'm just an idiot. And I said, guys,
you have to admit, I thought you were pretty far out there, too.
Well, I was. In 1980, I was really out there. But what I did, I don't mind admitting this, I knew that if I was, I said this when I did my interview at Channel 4 at that time, KDFW.
Right.
They actually had 44 sportscasters during the Vern Lundquist run of like 20 plus years. They went through 44 sportscasters.
God, I'd like to see that list.
Oh, it's pick somebody. I mean, they're on there, but they're on there for 6 months you're out, 3 months you're out, 4 months you're out. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I'd like to see it just from the standpoint of seeing how many of them I actually remember.
Oh, you'd know some. Norm Hitchkiss did it. Brad Sham did it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure I'd remember some, but I'll bet
Alan,
there's some.
Alan Stone did it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'd remember some, but I'll bet there's some that I wouldn't.
Oh, no, there'd be a ton of them. I'm sure you wouldn't. But anyway, I'm being interviewed for the job. I'd done a little bit of homework. I'm unemployed now. Keep this in mind. I was fired in Omaha, Nebraska. So I'm unemployed interviewing for a job in Dallas, and they put in a tape of Vern Lundquist. And we sat there and watched his sportscast, and then the general manager and the news director looked at me and said, can you do that? And I swear to you, on my sainted mother's grave, unemployed, I looked at him and said, I could, but I won't. And there was just this silence.
Let's see.
And John McKay, who was the general manager, says, so what would you do? And then I spelled out that I would do this, that, and some of that crazy stuff you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I got hired. Vern always took that as an insult. To me, it was the highest compliment that I could pay him, that I can't possibly make a mark. I can't possibly make a dent in the ratings if I try to be Vern Lundquist light. So So what I'm going to do is offer the viewer a completely different alternative and then hopefully carve out a pretty good slice of the pie, which is all I really did. And then as the pie got bigger, you know, and then the same thing, when I went to Channel 8, they said, we can't have that crazy ass shit you were doing on, can I say that here on the podcast?
It's yeah. Podcast. Say anything you want.
They said, we can't have that crazy ass shit you're doing at Channel 4. And I said, well, no, I'll do some of it. And see, I had people tell me who followed me from 4 to 8, oh, man, and this is, you're not nearly as crazy and funny as you were on Channel 4. And then I had people at Channel 8 saying, oh, hey, you're not really as crazy and stupid as we thought you were on Channel 4. And I think I've, as arrogant as that may sound, I think I've had a certain ability and a certain recognition of the marketplace to identify what works. But
yeah
people forget this, but I was pretty crazy in the early days.
You got to be able to read the room a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Which is exactly what I think you guys did at the Ticket. You read the room. People would sit there and go, oh, man, I can't stand Dunham and Miller. And, oh, the hardline Reiner and Williams, they make no sense to me. But then over the course of it, you're never going to get everybody.
No, you're not.
You're just not.
You're not.
And yet, I think it's the biggest mistake that most broadcasters make, I think in most news stations, radio stations. We want to appeal to everybody. And there was a radio station, I'm trying to think, remember the radio station that they played like, there was a country station, but they decided to like drop in one really hard rock song like every 15 minutes because they were trying to What? All you're going to do is drive away the country audience. And then at the same time, you're going, oh, yeah, maybe this person will sit through Willie Nelson and George Jones for 12 minutes just so they can hear Beyonce sing. Nah, it doesn't work. You carve out your niche, and then you own it.
Right. You want to take the exit ramp to failure, then just try to be all things to all people.
All people. Absolutely.
Yeah. Because you just can't do it. And you know, that's one thing that I don't know, we kind of knew going in when we started up the Ticket and everything like that. And one of the guiding principles was let's don't do that.
Yeah.
let's know and understand right up top that we can't be all things to all people. So probably the best play is let's just be us.
Be you.
Yeah.
Barry Horn, used to be the critic for the morning news.
Oh, yeah.
Wrote me and said, oh, okay, they're going to do this, or called me rather, and said, they're going to do this all sports 24/7. I said, that won't last long. And he goes, what do you mean? And this is where I get the good and the bad of this. Every guy, and again, for the most part, guys, but everybody who's a hardcore sports fan, especially TV and radio sportscasters, they think the whole world lives and dies, you know, with how the Cowboys do last night, how the Rangers do, how the Stars do, whatever. I learned this, my first TV job in 1977, I did an interview on the streets. Larry Bird had played in Omaha, Nebraska, four times his senior year. Played Indiana State, and they played Creighton.
Yeah, they played Creighton, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And every time Larry Bird came to town, there's front pages of the stories, and you know, Larry Bird's in town. I mean, he was fantastic. So when Larry Bird gets drafted by Boston, he was asking like for the astronomical sum of like $600,000, and he was like, had that little mini holdout. And I went on the street, did one of those Jay Leno walking.
Right,
you know,
right.
And what do you think of Larry Bird's demands? Thinking I'm going to get some, oh, he's being greedy, he's being so, whatever. 8 out of 10 people were like, I'm sorry, what's he do? So I turned the bid into, what does Larry Bird do, right? People didn't know. They did 80%. So I put it on the air. I'm thinking, God, that's some funny, you know, like the Jay Leno. Yeah. They don't know who the vice president is or whatever.
Yeah.
So
it's a big deal to us, but to them.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's huge. Yeah,
you know.
Bob Gibson, and I know you know the great Bob Gibson, had a steakhouse.
The late, great Bob Gibson.
Oh, my God, he was fantastic. Now, I got a great story for that one, if you want to hear it. But anyway, he had a steakhouse in Omaha, Nebraska. So I'd go to his restaurant. It was after the game one of the World Series.
Right.
And I'm interviewing the people, and I think it was like Philadelphia, Kansas City, or whoever, like 1978, 79, somewhere there. And I'm interviewing people in Bob Gibson's restaurant as to who's going to win the World Series. And this was after game one. And like five of them picked the Yankees and three of them picked the Cardinals. And again, I thought, that's hilarious. They don't even know, right? They don't even know that it's actually Philadelphia or, you know, whatever. And I put it on the air. Mark Gutierrez was the news director. He goes, so I've seen you do this bit. He says, so you think that's pretty funny? I said, I think it's hilarious. You know, he goes, yeah, I think it's funny, too, that you're telling our audience that 80 to 90% of the people never watch you. And it just hit me right between the eyes that it to me, it's like when the old radio stations would do those callers. We're going to call you, and if you answer the phone, hey, I'm listening to the ticket, we'll send you $1,000, whatever. Right. And they go days and days. So to me, all they were doing is like, oh, so you're not listening to us either. Okay, thanks for playing, you know. And that's when I stopped doing it, because I personally, especially back then, thought it was hilarious that these morons didn't know who's in the World Series. And the argument that everybody who's ever worked for me since has heard, I'm going to do a sportscast that appeals to Bob and Martha, preferably Martha. And we always do things like Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott. Every time I insist upon it that when you're doing a story, you're going to mention Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott. Whereas most sportscasters, well, you know, Dak broke his ankle. Trust me on this. There's thousands of people in Dallas-Fort Worth who don't know who Dak is. But to you and me and the guys like us, everybody knows Dak. Yeah,
to you and me, that's just superfluous information, you know? We're so steeped in it. We know it so well that it's second nature to us. And so we come on there and call him Dak, thinking everybody knows who that is.
But if you've made the choice, and this is my argument, if you make the choice to watch ESPN and you're the ticket radio, okay, well, now you're pretty much, you've brought yourself in. But what you guys did, and what I absolutely think I've done, is that I want my audience to broaden just a little bit more than Bob. Yeah. Bob's going to go around the dial, Bob knows. And you guys certainly did it at the ticket. Yeah, you're going to talk to me about Dak Prescott, but you're also going to bring in Martha. And if you get Martha, then you own him. You're going to own him. Because Martha's going to find out who she likes and she stays.
Right.
And that's why I've been my running gag, especially for the last 20-plus years. You know, that we get these salespeople, and I say, well, Dale, you have some remarkable high ratings among women. And I said, well, I think it's because of my firm jawline and my thick, black, wavy hair, you know. And maybe in my day, you know. But I just got an email last night, I promise you. And it's this woman, Sharon, who writes me all the time. And she said, the thing I like about you, I can follow everything you talk about. And it just doesn't take any time to say one time in the story, Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott, Cowboys owner Jerry Jones.
Sure.
Hey, you moved here from California. You're with that Toyota transfer or whatever, and you're not a hardcore sports fan, but you happen to have. Let me just tell you why I think this guy's a moron. He's the Cowboys owner, Jerry, you know, or whatever. And I just know it works. I just know it works. And every guy I've hired and every woman I've hired in the past 30 years, I've had to explain that to them, because they almost always like, well, everybody knows Jerry. Everybody knows you. I said, great. Go on the street corner. Go on a street corner right now and say, hey, what do you think about Zeke last night?
And see what you get.
Yeah, I promise you. And that's a hard one. But you know, go ask him, you know, what do you think about Kristaps? What do you think about him? You know, what about Luka? How's Luka doing? What do you think about Jamie? How's Jamie? Right? Rugi. Yeah. You and I, who doesn't know that? I'm just telling you. Yeah, everybody in our world.
Yeah, nobody in our world, but it's a big-ass world out there.
I'm trying to get a bigger piece of that pie in the world. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's kind of what we thought, too. I had another motive back then. I think I would have gone crazy if I had to talk all sports.
Oh, please, thank you.
I think I would have, man.
I've said many times, if my, and you mentioned a moment ago about doing the commentaries and, you know, the opinions and spouting off and everything. If I wasn't allowed to do that, I would have swallowed a bullet years ago. Or I'd have certainly walked away. I mean, I still love the theater of sports. I still love the drama. I love the storylines. But I'm sitting there. My wife's a huge Cowboys fan. I mean, she just loves the Cowboys. So we're sitting on the patio last night watching the game, waiting to go on to do the sports. And my wife just looks at me. She says, don't be too hard on him tonight. Now, don't you? She goes, you just enjoy this too much. And knowing that I was going to do this show today, I said, well, listen, I'm not Mike Reiner here. I mean, I'm not laughing out loud about it. Remember we used to do the talk shows on the post-game shows?
Oh, yeah.
And, oh, you just cracked me up all day because you're like, man, I loved every bit of it. I just loved every bit. I'm like, oh, my God, you can't say that. Well, yeah, you can. As I tried to explain to the lovely Mrs. Hansen and others, I do take a certain amount of satisfaction when they get their ass beat, the Cowboys I'm talking about. But it's not because I don't like the Cowboys. It's just because I just know it's just going to be such a hot-button day for sports. You know, if the Cowboys rip off 7-8 wins in a row, then I got a bunch of fans, oh, they're the greatest team in the world. But as you well know, when the Cowboys are losing, oh, this town's on fire.
That's when it's at its best.
Oh, this town's on fire. And the talk shows are going nuts. And everybody's got a reason and everybody's got an explanation. And we need to dump that stupid Dak Prescott. And we got to get rid of that lazy Zeke Elliott. And oh, let that Nietzsche kid play. I know he's great. I know he went. And I'm just like, I just eat that stuff up. And then I usually write something about it, make fun about it, whatever. But if I had to do what for the most part, I used to do in the 70s in particular when I started in Omaha, ball scores, highlights, Nebraska wins. Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
I'm out. Yeah. I'm out. Yeah. And again, what you created was the same concept. I can't do this. I mean, it's got to be more to my world and more to my life than that.
We're doing this on October 20th. That is the night after, or the day after, the Cowboys-Cardinals game.
Oh, wow.
Just to give everybody a little perspective. I know that we're not supposed to do this, but in podcasts, they are evergreen. They live forever.
yeah, so I've heard.
So what's the deal with this thing right now?
Oh, man.
I think something's really, really wrong here, Dale.
It might. I mean, that's the argument. And I'm trying, believe it or not, to cut them a little bit of slack because I do think you bring in a new head coach, you bring in a new staff, and then you have the virus shutting everything down. Where you can't really have practices and you can't.
And I'm trying to do the same thing because they didn't have training camp.
No. Nothing to resemble a training camp.
I don't know what practice looks like these days.
Well, that's my argument, though. Practice hadn't been much in my opinion. I said this one time and I'm not going to prove it now, but I could have gone through practice 10 years ago. And there's a realize, I could even put me out there. I mean, 10 years ago, at the age of 63, 62, and that was my main point. I said, I'm a 62-year-old fat guy, and I can do what these guys are doing. I mean, they stand around, they bump into one another, and then they throw a few screen passes. And I mean, compared to the good old days, you know, Jimmy Johnson would beat the hell out of somebody in practice.
Oh, yeah.
And then you had to run all those sprints at the end, and guys are throwing up in the grass, and oh, the asthma field's over there.
Here's Jimmy with the asthma field.
My boy Galloway started. Wade Phillips was ahead of his time. Wade Phillips comes in, and Galloway kept calling it, you know, Camp Cupcake and everything, and it was. And I get to San Antonio's where it started, but that's the way they all practice now, which I still think is part of the reason there's so many injuries in the NFL right now. I mean, it's a violent sport, but you know, you look. Like when Muhammad Ali is getting ready to fight Sonny Liston, there's an old-time reference for somebody. Now, a bunch of your listeners are like, oh, man, I got to Google that. But, you know,
okay,
you
Google it. There's big payoff there if you Google Sonny Liston.
If you don't know, it's a big, big payoff. But I'm saying, you know, they spar, they practice, they get the medicine ball slammed into their stomach, you know, and so that when they finally do get hit in the ring, I'm thinking anyway, well, okay, I've felt that before. I'm saying, now a guy goes out, bumps into the guy on the other side of the line. He falls down. He grabbing his thigh and his. You know, how the hell did that hurt?
Yeah, because he just took the hardest hit he's taken all week,
all summer.
Yeah, all summer.
And this is the other reason I throw him just a little bit of rope. Although I do think they've got some problems on defense in particular. That people who know a great deal more about it than me say that Mike Nolan's defense is just out of whack. I mean, it's just out of whack. But look at the starters. They got 9 starters on injured reserve. Mm-hmm. And that offensive line they had last night, for example, was like 5 guys named Bob and 2 Larrys were backups. I mean, who are they? They're just all the typical 310-pound guys that can bench press 550. And, you know, some of them can block a little bit. Most of them can't. The defense has got injuries, racked with injuries. And then you mix in the fact that, yes, the backups aren't very good. But in a salary cap league, you can't have the backups that the Cowboys used to have in the 90s and
You don't get any depth in a salary cap league, but it's been that way for years. You know? It's been that way for years.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know when they've lost 9 starters in the first 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And now you throw in the quarterback, which is in a game where the quarterback dominates it. But no, I'm not saying that there's not something seriously wrong here. But I just think when you throw it all into that big old pot,
yeah,
and you start mixing it up, no training camp, no real practice time together, injuries that just keep piling up. And again, McCarthy in particular, I think McCarthy's made a couple of mistakes along the way. I mean, not kicking that field goal in L.A. kind of set the tone. I thought that was incredibly stupid in the season opener. He's done a few things along the way that don't make a lot of sense to me anyway. But the other thing, and I know you've said this 100 times over the years, every year the Cowboys start talking about this is going to be their year. And all we hear about is that right tackle who's so good and that left tackle who's all pro and all this linebacker. Well, I always fall back on this story. I was going to radio school in Milwaukee in 1971, 72, somewhere in there. And all I had was the Milwaukee TV stations and the Milwaukee papers. And all they wrote about was the Green Bay Packers. And I thought, man, oh, man, they got Bart Starr coaching. And they got all these great linemen, and they got this fast receiver. And they got this kid who like serves the food to the homeless on his days off. And I mean, this is the greatest group of guys I've ever seen collected. So I figured, sure as hell, they're going to win 12, 13 games. They won like 4, because everybody's got a 300-pound lineman nowadays that can bench press 500. Every receiver could run a 4.440. Quarterbacks, this. A little bit better. But the hometown fan, they get spoon-fed all this propaganda, and they just buy in that, it's great. They're great. No, they're not. Sometimes they're not.
I don't know. I look at the Cowboys these days, the Cowboys of this year, and it seems like, and I know this gets back to maybe to no training camp and all that sort of thing, but just in the way the team is constructed, in the way they go about their business, I just don't see much attention to detail out there. Football is a detail-oriented game.
This is what I've thrown this back on Jerry Jones for 25 years, and I think, unfortunately, I'm right about this. I think the way he runs that organization since Jimmy left, it's a joke. He lets the players make all these decisions. Excuse me. You've heard the latest. Now the story's starting to break that, the players are pointing fingers at all the coaches.
Yeah.
Well,
one guy says he's just not good at his job today.
Yeah, well, I pointed about 20 of those guys. But again, all the teams that we've covered together over the years, have you ever interviewed a player and on a bad team and had that player go, they need to replace me. I'm just not really very good at this. Have you ever heard a guy say that? And no matter who it is, it's the manager's fault. It's the coach's fault. It's the offensive coordinator's fault. It always is. Now, is there some truth to it? Yeah, okay, maybe. But I just kind of laugh that off when I hear it because I've heard it 1,000 times. I know you have as well. I mean, even like the Rangers during all those bad years that we were out there with them. And, you talk to him, this manager, he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. The general manager's not getting us any good players, whatever. Well, maybe because they got you. And you're just not any good, And no, that was never the argument. Never once have I had a player say to me, I'm just not real good at this.
No, don't think I've ever heard that one either.
But I think Jerry creates this environment where the players can do no wrong. The players have a great deal of autonomy. And I think it's just an example of what I consider to be part of the problem is that when you have players who apparently are willing to call out their coaches, gee whiz, if you did that at Channel 8, and if you did it in my department, you won't do it twice.
Yeah.
If you did it when the great Marty Haig was running that station, thanks for playing, you didn't say things like that. Now you might sit over at good old Joe Miller's or Louis some night and go, oh man, this is what a mess we had going, you know. But I mean, no, there's no fear. I mean, the players are a protected class.
Yeah.
And there's no fear. And again, when they've got the money, okay, it does give you the freedom to do that. But nah, there's no accountability. There, as you say, there's no attention to detail. They're all fine. They're all happy. They're all well fed. They don't care.
No, they just don't care. Yeah. You know, you smartly segued into another thing that I wanted to get to with you, and that is the halcyon days of Channel 8.
Yeah.
During the Marty Hague years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
That was just an incredibly outstanding newscast. Night in, night out. I mean, it was unparalleled. And I was fortunate enough to cut my teeth in this game in the same building. And I walked through that, or around, not through, around that newsroom every day as I was leaving, and whenever I would come up there for any reason, you know, we were upstairs, and I would walk through there, and I mean, the Channel 8 newsroom of back then just smacked of professionalism. If we're going to do this shit, we're going to do it right. We're going to get the story right. And when we present it, nobody's going to do it better. I mean, the standard that you guys were held to must have been just incredibly high. And you all bought in.
We did buy in. And that's a conversation that you remember Byron Harris, who retired recently.
Yes.
We were always, I still am, referred to as, that's the old guard complaining. That's the old guard talking.
I know this is good old days syndrome for sure. You know,
unfortunately, I don't have a really good filter on myself here, so I may say something that gets me in trouble, but if I do, so be it.
It's a podcast. Nobody listens.
Yeah. In fact, once they realize it's me on here, not that many people are going to be listening anyway, you know. But here's what I think is true. It's certainly just part of the industry as a whole. I mean, we used to have like this unlimited budget.
Yeah.
I mean, and I've said this. It used to be like, and I'll give you the best example of all. The Hurricanes were hitting Florida. We send Scott Pelley. I mean, this is what I find funny. Here's a guy that went on now at 60 Minutes. Here's a guy, and I tell the younger people now, they kind of look at me like, what? Scott Pelley, who was a CBS evening news anchor for several years, not very good at that particular job, by the way, but a hell of a reporter, now on 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. He was just one of our guys in the newsroom that we got tired of because he was always complaining that he didn't have the lead story. Now, he fought so hard to have the lead story. We're like, yeah, shut up, you know, because we've got Peter Van Zandt. We had Doug Fox. And he was just a guy, which to me kind of says you had Scott Pelley as just a guy in your newsroom.
Yeah.
Because he in many ways, he was. Now, we knew he was good. We knew he was dedicated. We knew he'd probably going to zoom out. But it was that kind of a department. But without question, Marty Hague set the tone. And I feel somewhat comfortable saying this because the person is no longer there. But I was screaming at somebody one night after a show messed up, and I'm bitching at him the next day or whatever. And I get called into the front office because one of our producers had complained that I was intimidating, you know, with my loud voice and whatever. So I get called into the general manager's office, and the general manager looks at me and said, Dale, you can't treat people like that. I said, what? I mean, I just said, I mean, I'm screaming a little bit, but not even at my best. But I mean, she messed up the whole show. I mean, she screwed up. But, you know, well, Dale, you just can't. I said, Marty, and I swear to God, this is a true story. Marty Hague, I looked at the general manager, and I said, Marty Hague would have done a hell of a lot worse than what I did. And the general manager looks at me and says, Marty Hague can't work here anymore. And it just, it was like a hot knife cut through me. I went, I'm sorry, what? He said, Dale, in the climate of today, Marty Hague would never be allowed to work here. And I looked at the general manager, I swear to you, and I said, I think that says a hell of a lot more about you than it does Marty Hague. And I get in trouble for this, and if somebody at Channel 8 hears this podcast, I'll probably get in trouble again. I'm not blaming any individuals that we have. I'm not. I'm not pointing a finger at any of the individuals that are working there now. But I think without question, you know, we do live in an environment where we give out participation trophies,
yes,
which I think has just been a death knell for our kids. You know, we have this, oh, Bobby, don't, you know, a timeout in the corner. Nah, just slap that son of a bitch upside the head, you know. And, I mean, no. Bobby's not comfortable. Bobby's not comfortable with the teacher correcting him in front of the class. And here's little Johnny who can't play baseball with a lick. Give him the same trophy that you give the next Mike Trout kid over. I mean, come on. That's just stupid in my old-fashioned ways. And I do. And I sat there arguing. I said, you know, we make mistakes sometimes that people would have been fired for, quite frankly, years before. And now it's like, yeah, you really need to stop doing that. You really got to stop doing that. And again, it's not all the manager's fault. It is the new world we live in. Then you add to it that there was a day, and I still argue this, there was a day when we would Channel 8 News would say, we have to cover that story, and oh my God, we're going to spend the next 2 weeks figuring out how we pay for it. Now, we figure out how we're going to pay for it before we cover a lot of our stories. And one of the breaking points for John McKay, the former anchor there for 20 years, mm-hmm, Barack Obama becomes the first black man elected president of the United States. I'm thinking, that crosses a few boundaries. That's up there.
Sure.
We didn't go to Chicago for his acceptance speech, and everybody's there. John McKay obviously desperately wanted to be in Chicago and wanted to be anchoring from... Nah, we just picked up a network feed of that. Now, back to what we were talking about earlier. That's the future, because it costs a great deal of money to send John McKay and a crew and get the satellite time. And, you know, I mean, it's a lot of money.
Sure.
But when you used to have Scott Pelley standing in Washington, D.C. after the State of the Union address, it said something to the Dallas viewer. I think without question. You know, and then Scott Pelley would interview the Texas senators and get their response, and the Texas congressmen and women. And hurricanes in Florida, and yeah, Dale Hansen's live in Florida with the Rangers, and Dale Hansen's live in California with the Cowboys.
Well, you know, it showed commitment.
It showed total commitment.
Yeah, it showed now, commitment, yeah, and it showed your audience that, hey, we're really into this.
But
and we're going to bring you as close
are
to this as we can.
I mean, I think I still think I work in, and I'm not saying this, you know I wouldn't just say it. I work with a lot of very, very good people, and I think there are some incredibly committed people to the industry of what we're trying to do. But you just can't do it anymore. I mean, we used to, this is the argument that I make. We used to answer to Robert Decker. All right, he was like the head honcho guy.
Sure.
Right? Below the corporate ownership was a local group,
right?
So when we would do something good, Robert Decker would be sitting over there at his country club, at Dallas Country Club or whatever, or having lunch at the Citibank Towers or whatever they're called. And you know somebody, hey, by the way, I saw what you guys did last night on WFAA, and oh my God, that was impressive. And then he'd get that budget. He goes, oh my, well, that Marty Hague, well, that's what we had to spend to do the job. Yeah, but his buddies liked it. Well, now those same people are in Virginia. You know, and we have a guy that I think is incredible, has this news bent, but he also answers to a board of directors. He answers to people that they don't know Dale Hansen. They don't know local news. They don't, you know. They're looking at that bottom line.
Right. That's all they're looking at.
For the most part, what they're trying to do is do the best job they can with the bottom line being the overriding factor. And right or wrong, and I'm not the first person to say this, it goes back to like the network news. Before news became a moneymaker, the news was better. It used to be, well, we have to send a crew to Vietnam because that's what we do. We owe it to the community. But it's like the Edward R. Murrow. Did you ever see the movie with Edward R. Murrow? And I think Edward R. And they said, well, Ed, I mean, you know, advertisers aren't buying it. He goes, yeah, but I'm doing some of the most amazing work ever. nah, we're going to put a game show on. We're going to put a sitcom on. And you can have Sunday mornings at 6 o'clock. And that was the, because that now they realize, hey, we if we can't make money off the news, then the news is out. Locally, we still make a great deal of money off the news. But, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating to me. I mean, it's all of society. I mean, it's all, and certainly the virus is, I think, just kind of shined a light on that. That, you know, who does things now in the community, period? Pick anybody. Who does things now because it's the right thing to do? They don't do that.
No.
No. Whether it's the local restaurant, whether it's the local radio station you worked at, whether it's the local TV station I work at, whether it's the car dealership, whether they don't do that, you know, how much money can we make?
Yeah,
and we answer
because it's the right thing to do as long as there's money in it.
Yeah, yes. As long as either you make money doing it,
yeah,
or you know, but to say, hey, this show's entertaining, this show's important, this show's informative. No, that's never the consideration. And again, as people, and probably somewhat rightfully, will say to me in our business, in our newsroom now, yeah, well, you and your Marty Haig stories, get the hell out of here. You know, I'm like, yeah, but we would send crews on trips that we just don't do anymore. You know, and now, does it really matter? Well, again, that's to be decided, I guess. But and I do think what you said earlier is. If I thought it was bad before, oh, I think it's going to get potentially much worse. Because now we have figured out, like Arnold, you know Arnold Payne, and man, he shoots the lights out for stories that he covers.
Love AP.
And I'm like, yeah, AP, I think there's a very good chance you never make a Cowboys trip again.
Wow.
And he just, that's his whole deal. He lives and breathes to be on that sideline shooting pictures, getting us those shots that you just don't see without AP's camera being there.
But you can't get anywhere else.
But, you know, all we got to do is just record the Fox broadcast, and we show the same plays that everybody in town shows. We have the same reactions to those plays that the network may or may not have shown us. I mean, you know, one of my biggest pet peeves is that like the basketball playoffs. And well, of course, they didn't have a lot of options this year, but I said, they just show the court. You know, the guy makes a basket and he runs down. And no, I want to see the coach screaming. I want to see the fans screaming. College football. To me, the environment, I think this is where Tex Schramm, the great former general manager of the Cowboys, was way ahead of his time. He knew that the entire environment was part of the deal. So when I came, if you remember, I'm showing those Cowboys cheerleaders all the time. Now, one, because I was a bit of a sexist pig in my day, you know. But as I said to remember Wendell Barnhouse, just ripped the hell out of me. Because believe it or not, Mike, I was the first guy on television in Dallas to use cutaways. You know, the shot of the cheering fan or the cheerleader or whatever. Everybody else just play this way, play that way, play this way, play that. You know, just I can't hardly keep up. I use cutaways, and I did it for two reasons. One, it makes it easier for the viewer to kind of follow along, to kind of, oh, that was a touchdown. Now let's take a breath, and here comes another touchdown. More importantly, I wanted to show the cheerleaders. And Wendell Barnhouse just ripped the hell out of me for it, an article in the Star-Telegram one time. And he said, why do you do that? I said, well, number one, who watches football? Men, for the most part. What do men like? They like football, and they like beautiful young ladies. And if you watch me, you get both.
Yeah.
And simple. Now, in 1981, it was funny. A little more sexist today, maybe, whatever. So we now we show the fans in the stands, and we show the kids, you know, whatever. And it's just that little subtle difference that makes it easier for Martha to follow along, or Bob and Martha to follow along. And, you know, I said, well, I'm not leaving out any plays to accommodate these cheerleader shots. I mean, I'm not doing that. But he for some reason, he thought I did because nobody else was doing it.
All right, you mentioned something a minute ago I want to touch on, because occasionally when I run into a new guy coming up in the media, something like this will come up, and I always try to tell him about Joe Miller's.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I miss that
place. The greatness
place.
Of Joe Miller's.
Oh, the best. Yeah, yeah.
For those who may not know, Joe Miller's became kind of the – and this started back in the, I guess, late 70s, maybe even before that. I'm not really sure.
Well, I think Joe was around for probably the entire decade of the 70s.
Yeah.
I think he got his own bar like mid-70s, I think. Yeah. That, something like that.
And it became...
I wasn't here then, but I think
it became the big media hangout.
Oh, without question, yeah.
I don't know how...
And lawyers.
Yeah.
Judges.
Yeah, it was kind of... It became kind of, I don't know, a place that you might read about, like, somebody's writing a book about New York in the 1920s or 30s, yeah, yeah. You know, where all the dandies might go, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that kind of place, a place where the literati and the cognoscenti would hang out at everything.
Oh, man.
And I try to explain to him about Joe Miller's and what Joe Miller's was like and everything. And, I mean, I didn't hang out there that much because, you know, I was doing morning drive back then.
Yeah,
And I just... can hang very late, you know, but
well, I made up for it.
Oh yeah, you did. I love that place, man.
I love that place. I mean, but I also, I like just a good bar. I mean, it was an outrageous bar. Nobody hitting on him. You know, some guy in the corner be hitting on some gal and he come up, go get a room. Get out, you know. You had peanuts as your appetizer to kind of help you wash down. That was my beer drinking days. Oh, my God. But I just love. But what I really loved about it was just that I'm sitting there, and, you know, there's the guys from the radio station. There's the other newspaper guys who are over there. And we'd have some of the greatest conversations.
Yes, it's where you really got to know people.
I sat there one night. People find this hard to believe. I think you might even find this hard to believe. But I sat there one night with Blackie Sherrod, the great Blackie Sherrod.
Oh, the great Blackie Sherrod.
Former sports writer in the Dallas area forever. And believe this or not, and most people don't, I sat there for about an hour and didn't say a word. Because Blackie's stories and his group of people that were around his table, and somehow I got invited in late at night. And the one story I'll never forget, he told a story about covering Sonny Liston when I mentioned the fight against, well, it was Cassius Clay at the time. Yeah. Right? And he says, I'm telling you, he's from Mars. And I'm like, sorry, what? And he goes, I was there. Sonny Liston does not breathe. Sonny Liston does not breathe. He's from Mars. And for some reason, that had just stuck with me for 30 plus years. But listening to Blackie puffing on those damn cigarettes of his, drinking his booze, that was, you can't recreate that anywhere.
No,
and then
can't.
Then we went from there to Pat Snuffer's when there was that little bit of a downtime when Joe died. And then we went to Pat Snuffer's and all the TV stations primarily. They didn't have the newspaper guys there, but all the TV stations would get together. I love those days. And we don't do that at all anymore. I mean, everybody just goes home. But it was the strangest thing. Joe Miller died. It was shortly after I'd started at Channel 8. So I think it was might have been 83, 84, something like that when Joe died.
Yeah, something like that.
And they actually had me do a commentary. One of the first things I ever wrote was about the death of my friend Joe Miller. And I thought, a Marty Haig news station, and I'm going to write about my friend, the bartender. And Marty said, yeah. He said, he says, can you kind of, not just Joe, but tell people what it is, what it's like. And I wrote a piece, and then I walked back in. We were having a big wake for Joe that night. So, typical me, I'm up there at 6:30, you know, and I got to go back and do that commentary. And so they all turn on the TV, and half of them are like, oh, man, he can't go do the news now, can he? And Louis was there, you know, Louis, the great bartender.
Right.
Louis like, oh, yeah, when do you see this? And I do this commentary about the death of my friend Joe Miller. Walk back into the bar, place just starts roaring, and we drank till about 5 o'clock in the morning. And
awesome.
It was a different time, as I tell the young people nowadays. But
it was a different time.
But it was just, did you ever get in there when he was dying of brain cancer and you play tic-tac-toe on his head, and if you won the game, he'd give you a free drink. And he had the tic-tac-toe thing drawn on his head where he was taking radiation. And he'd walk up to me and hand me a Sharpie, and I'd put an X, you know, on the corner of his head. Then he'd walk over to somebody else. They'd put an O, and they'd come back to me, and I'd put an X. And if you were ever able to win a game, you got a free drink. And I said, well, I said, this game ends in a draw like 99% of the time. And Joe looked at me and said, what do you think? I'm just going to sit here and give everybody free drinks? Ah, hell no. You know, and we would draw.
Man had a plan.
Oh, he was – when the lovely Mrs. Hansen and I went to his funeral, it was a huge, huge turnout, obviously. And – my wife was she still talks about it. We walk out because you know how he loved that piano and jazz music and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was put on a happy face. And she just couldn't understand that. I mean, because, you know, at that time of our lives, I mean, you know, people died. It's, hey, it's sobbing time. It's crying time. It's, you know, and I just started laughing my ass off, you know, that. No, that's Joe Miller. I mean, of course, we, you know, I start laughing as we're walking out of the service. And my wife is like, what are you doing? I said, Joe would slap me upside the head if I was crying right now. And put on a happy face as you walked out of the church after his funeral. I mean, it was brilliant touch, which is what I'm going to do when I die.
Not that
particular song, but I'm going to do the same concept.
Oh, what's your song going to be?
Forever Young. I've got three songs, and I'm doing Rod Stewart's version of them, by the way. I know Forever Young is Bob Dylan's song, but I want people to be able to understand the words. I love Dylan, but my daughter went down. I was playing these clips, and I had Dylan on the car, and I'm just, oh, my God. He was the poet of a generation. And my 14-year-old daughter goes, you like this shit? And I'm like, no, I don't like it. I love it. But when you walk into my service, whatever, you know, when you walk in, it'll be Rod Stewart singing Sam Cooke's song, We're Having a Party. That will be when you walk in. And as everybody's getting settled or the ceremony's starting, it's We're Having a Party. Originally by Sam Cooke, which I love that version too, but again, it's an ode to Rod Stewart. And then in the middle, there'll probably be the video piece, which will be to Some Men Have All the Luck. Which I've never denied that. I am one of the luckiest men that ever popped onto the planet. Every step of my life has just been, really? I mean, and you well know many of those stories. So it'll be Sean Hamilton's going to put a video together of Some Men Have All the Luck. And then as the ceremony ends, it'll be Rod Stewart's Forever Young. And, well, Rod Stewart's version of Forever Young. It's already laid out. I paid for it about a month ago. I paid for the whole thing.
Excellent.
I wrote the...
Only you come up with something
well,
like that.
Well, I wrote the check. I mean, you know, the funeral home... so I thought, well, I just want to get all this done. You know,
yeah, sure.
I don't want
a plan.
I don't want people to have to mess with it, you know, whatever. And I think that is smart because, you know, it's like a car dealer, you know. Oh, well, you sure you don't want the undercoating on that? I mean, you got to, you know, you sure you don't want some extra protection insurance? And I think the same thing happens in the mortuary business, you know. Well, you don't want them to, like, spend all of eternity in that casket. Let me show you a really good casket, you know. I'm going to be cremated. And I was on Dunham and Miller's show one time. And I said, the only thing I'm concerned about, there's going to be a grease fire from hell when they throw my fat ass in there to cremate me. I mean, there'll be fire trucks coming from five counties around, you know. I mean, there'll be so much smoke coming out of that crematorium that there'll be everybody in Midlothian, all the Catholics will think they're the new pope. I mean, it'll be crazy. But I'm going to be cremated. And as I said, I was joking, but I said to the woman, she goes, well, now, where do you want to have the service? And I did mean it as a joke, but unfortunately, the joke has traveled through Waxahachie, and some people laugh like hell, and some people are like, oh, that's him, that cocky. I said, well, it depends. You know, I said, I mean, if I die today, I said, I think you'll have to get the Cowboys stadium. You know, you probably have to hold it in the Cowboys stadium.
Sure.
If I die in another year or two, we can just do it up at the convention center here in Waxahachie. And if I die in another 5, 6, 7 years, well, we can just all meet at McDonald's and have a hamburger in the parking lot, and that'll be about all. I mean, it was a joke. But it's one of the things that always bothered me. When Blackie Sherrod died, one of the most influential writers of our entire generation. But hell, he lived to be like 95 years old. And by the time he died, there was like six of us, you know, meeting up over at Brook Hollow for cheese and wine and telling Blackie Sherrod stories. And I thought it was incredibly sad because Blackie had outlived everybody.
Yeah.
For the most part. I mean, Galloway was there. I was there. Kevin Sherrington, a few people in the morning news, you know, whatever. Jerry Todd, guys, you know, different guys, right. You know. But not the ceremony that Blackie Sherrod should have had. And so I sit there, and I do. I kind of use it to justify, well, hey, if I die today, I'm thinking there might be a story out of that, you know. If I die in 3-4 years, yeah, certainly I'll get on the sports page. And if I die in 10 years, I go, who? I mean, you know, that's life, you know.
It's all timing, man. It's all timing.
But I do have the desire to I want everybody dead before I die. So I want to be 106. I've got no problem with that. You know, I'm not into that dying thing.
So. How'd you get into the game?
Which game? This?
TV, sports, radio,
well,
whatever.
I'm telling you, this is where it all started, where it really crystallized just how lucky I was. I'd done radio. I'd been fired from about every one of my radio jobs. And
all right, how'd you get into that, though?
I went to a school because I got fired from a job as a bill collector. So I was laying in bed. This is absolutely true. I'm laying on the floor, watching TV late at night.
What year?
1971.
Okay.
And this commercial comes on the air. And late night TV, and it said, if you sound like this, you can make millions of dollars in the fabulous world of broadcasting. And I'm thinking, hell, I think I sound like that, right? People say I got it off a matchbook cover. I did not. I got it off a late night infomercial. And it was a school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it cost me like $4,500 that the government paid for, because I served in the Navy, so I got the GI Bill thing or whatever.
Yep.
My dad drives me up to Milwaukee. First floor was hotel management. Second floor was dental hygienist training. And the third floor was broadcast school. And it was just records. We played records. Merle Harmon, you remember the old Ranger?
Yeah, sure.
Merle Harmon. And one of these tips that I've taken, he said, when you're doing sports, speak quickly. Speak fast. Speaking fast conveys enthusiasm. So when you're doing sports, always talk faster than when you're doing commercials, because now I want you. And I bought it, and it worked for the most part. And so I'm on this goofy thing. It was a ripoff school, but it was fun. It was crazy. First time I ever smoked marijuana in my life. I'm 24 years old. Everybody thought I was a planted narc when I asked a couple of guys, you know, because everybody else was like 18 years old, right? I said, hey, you guys got any, you guys got like any marijuana? You know, I didn't know the lingo or whatever.
I remember those days.
Yeah, yeah. And so they wouldn't admit anything because they thought I was a planted narc. And but anyway, I'm going through this school, and I know this is my last chance. I mean, I failed at everything else, and I can't go to work. I can do, as arrogant as this sounds, I can do any job you put in front of me. I just can't do it 8 to 5 with a 1 hour break for lunch. Tell me what job you want done. I'll figure it out. I can do it, but I have to do it on my own timetable. And I cannot go to work at 8 o'clock, take a break for lunch, come back at 1 o'clock and work till 5. I can't
do it again the next day.
Yeah.
The day after that.
And I was selling and a bill collector. Oh my God. So anyway, I get fired. So I go to that school. Well, and I'm studying, believe it or not, with that exception, there was a 4-day window in there when I was actually smoking the marijuana for 4 straight days. And they threw this pop quiz. And again, I'm acing everything they got because I'm at school at night just listening to Merle Harmon records and practicing and everything. And they throw this pop quiz. I'm far and away the best student they've got. And it really was like that commercial. I'm like, how often do you give a station ID? Whenever you remember what your call letters are. I mean, it was like a bad Cheech and Chong bit, you know. And I miss everything. I'm just, it was like that old commercial. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs.
Right.
Well, that is my brain. When I did marijuana, boom, I'm gone. So luckily for me, the instructor of that particular class was a 28-year-old disc jockey in Milwaukee. And he calls me up after the class. He says, what in the hell? He, oh, God, you're stoned. And I went, yeah, no, I'm good, man. I'm really good, you know. And he goes, I'll never get it. He says, you're good at this. He said, I think you could really be successful. I mean, because I think you're really, really good. But not if you smoke marijuana, you're not.
Does that guy know where you are today?
I've never touched it since.
Have you talked to him since?
No. God, I wish I could find him. I've tracked down, and also I've tracked down, three or four people that I've come across over the years, and because I really did. I'm kind of into this. Hey, I want to just thank you one more time before whatever.
Yeah.
But I have no idea where he is or who he is. But I wish I could, because it changed. I mean, I immediately stopped. About a month later, they said, hey, there's a radio station in Iowa looking for a disc jockey, which is really, that was my only goal in life. I wanted to be a disc jockey. And they said, we think you should go apply for it. I mean, you're from Iowa. You're good at this. You sound good, whatever. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I got like 6 weeks to go in the school. And they said, no, forget it. Forget it. So I drive to Newton, Iowa. I apply for the job. I get hired. $94 a week. And I'm spinning records. January 2nd, 1972, I start spinning records from 1 till 5 in the afternoon. And then it just took off. I got one job after another, you know, followed the game.
Right.
And then when I finally got my first TV job, the same kind of a break. I get fired at a radio station in Omaha, Nebraska. And the girl that I was dating at the time said, I had a job offer in Galveston, Texas. And she said, I don't want to go to Texas. I said, well, baby, I'd kind of like you to go with me. No. She said, get a job in Omaha. I said, I've applied at every radio station there is. She said, well, you always wanted to be on TV. And I swear to God, this is amazing how this works out. And I got to put the punctuation mark on it at the end, if you'll allow me. I walked in that door, applied. The guy said, yeah, I've heard you on the radio. Come on in. I just called him cold. He said, Dale, where'd you go to school? I said, Logan, Iowa. He said, no, I mean, your college. You have to have a college degree to work here. And I said, well, I never did. He said, well, Dale, I can't, nothing to discuss. As I'm saying that, the phone rings, and his weekend sportscaster quit. He looks at me just out of disgust and says, hey, kid, because I was like 28, something like that, 27. He goes, hey, kid, you like sports? Hell, I love sports. I'm just looking for a job, right? And he goes, how would you like to be the weekend sportscaster? And I promise you, Mike, this is true. He said, how would you like to be the weekend sportscaster? I said, well, you said everybody who works here has to have a college degree. He goes, not to be a sportscaster. You don't need any education at all for that job. So we auditioned. There were 11 of us on a Saturday morning. He walks in, a guy named Mark Couture. He said, gentlemen, no teleprompter will be used for the audition. And 10 guys went, oh, God. And I looked up and said, what exactly is a teleprompter? I had no idea. I had no idea. Killed it.
Just winging it.
Well, I had the ability back then, and I still do to some extent, not quite as well as I used to, but I knew that they always looked right into the camera, so I assume you memorize your scripts. So he said, I'm going to give you 30 minutes. Go write a four-minute sportscast. So I went up, wrote it, memorized it. Boom, right here. The guy came up, well, no, he said, now then we're going to use two cameras. I said, oh, my God, how do I know which camera I'm on? Paul Young was the director who followed me to Dallas. And he goes, you've really never done this. I said, no, but just tell me. So he draws an arrow on my script. He said, when you're reading this line, just look down and then look up over here and I'll change the camera. Don't you worry about it. Then look back down, look back up. Piece of cake. So I'm the only one of the 11 who's looking into the camera. I'm looking right into the camera. Well, the story part that's hard for people to believe, this is 1977. I had radio hair. I had hair down onto my collar, down my shoulders, had big old mutton chop sideburns, you know, I mean, trying to look like John Lennon or something.
Any pictures of this floating around out there?
I hope not. No, God, I was an ugly son of a bitch. So I'm calling. I mean, I had a perm in it. I had an afro perm in it because my hair's always been kind of thin. So I would get up in the morning working at the rock and roll stations where I did, and I'd wash out my hair, and I never combed it, just ran my hands through it, and it just flowed. I had this big old bushy head of hair.
I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, those are the days. And then with these big, ugly mutton chop sideburns. And anyway, he says, yeah, we'll get back to you. A couple weeks go by. So now the station in Galveston is calling. I said, oh, my grandmother died. I'll be there next week. Okay. Oh, my car broke down. I'll be there next week. Oh, my grandmother died. He said, how many damn grandmothers do you have? So I believe this is the third one you've killed off, right? True. Finally, the light bulb goes off. And I call my dad, because I had no money. I had nothing. I said, Dad, I need some money to buy a suit. I buy a new suit, white shirt, red tie, red power tie. I walk into the woman who cut my hair all the time, who Well, as I like to say, she used to style my hair. Now I'm telling her, cut it off. Had to get the old like Brill Cream butch wax stuff to get it to lay down. I look like I stepped out of a Brooks Brothers ad. I called Mark Gutierrez. I said, I got to go to Galveston for this radio job. Can I come see you before I go? He said, sure, come on in. I walk in looking like I just stepped out of a magazine ad for hardcore right-wing conservative Republican guy.
Like you had the suit on?
Oh, yeah,
everything?
Suit, tie, you know, little short hair, just greased down. Oh, yeah, I look special. I look special. And he hired me right on the spot. And I looked at him. I said, so you didn't like the hair? Yeah. Well, anyway, and I've told the story about that, but here's the punctuation to this story. And that's why I always say, I'm just the luckiest guy in the world. I've never denied that. I get fired in Omaha. I come to Dallas. The guy who fired me in Omaha fires me at Channel 4. The day Bill Wilson. They fired me at Channel 4. Now, think about this, Mike. I had like 2 months left on my contract. They could have fired me basically any time during that 2 months.
Sure.
They picked this particular Monday morning to fire me. The same Monday morning, the Channel 8 hired a new guy to replace Carl Arkey, was the guy's name, was doing the 10 o'clock show. And they decided that they wanted to replace Carl Arkey. So that very same Monday morning, they call this young man in Alabama, and they say, the job is yours. The next morning, Ed Bark writes a column in the Dallas Morning News, Dale Hansen's been fired at Channel 4. And Terry Ford, who was the station, is everybody following this? Terry Ford was the station manager. He says, I want to talk to Hansen.
And Marty Station Hague manager at Channel 8, right?
At Channel 8.
Okay.
And Marty Hague and Dave Lane, the greatest general manager in the history of television news, said, no, we don't like Dale Hansen. He's crazy. I mean, he's crazy. We don't want to talk to him. And Terry Ford said, hey, and this is one of the greatness of Channel 8. They do it to this day. Whatever your job is, you get to do that job. It's kind of a strange concept. They let people do their jobs. And Dave Lane said, I don't like him, but if you want to talk to him, go ahead. Marty Hague says, I really don't like him. He's not going to fit here. And Terry Ford said, well, at least talk to him because I really like what he does at Channel 4, believe it or not. I then interview. They called the guy in Alabama and said, hold on a second. I interview with Marty Hague. Now, here's the arrogant thing of all time. I've only had 11 jobs in my life. And I mean, my professional life, I've only had 11. And I've interviewed for 11 jobs. Now, I've been turned down hundreds of times. But I've only sat across the desk and interviewed for 11 jobs.
And you got every one of them.
Got every one of them. And I just believe this. So I tell my wife, I tell the lovely Mrs. Hansen, hey, I'm going to Channel 8. She said, you haven't even interviewed yet. I said, doesn't make any difference. If I get in the door, I'll get hired. I mean, I know how arrogant that sounds, but it's true. And Marty Hague said it.
Some people just know how to do that.
I just know which buttons to push.
Yeah.
And Marty Hague said afterwards, she says, I fully expected him to walk in with a clown suit on, with grenades strapped to his hip, blowing up everything in his path. And he says, actually, he's got some really good ideas. He knows what he's doing, and he knows why he's doing it. And Marty Hague said to me, well, if we do hire you, would you do the same thing you're doing at Channel 4? I said, oh, goodness, no. No. I said, you got Jerry Orr. I don't have to be as funny. I don't have to be as crazy. I'll let Jerry Orr be the funny guy. But I said, and then he says to me, well, so you'll do it like Vern. I said, oh, God, no. And Vern's still there. I said, no, I'm not. He said, well, what would you do differently? I said, well, number one, I wouldn't do any ball scores. Remember the old days when I started that nonsense? Everybody was up in arms. I said, yep. I'm not doing any ball scores. I'm going to do predominantly local stories. I mean, we'll do some national baseball in the summer, whatever. But we'll, you know, it'll be geared more toward local. I said, I'm going to cover the hell out of the high schools, which you guys don't do at all, because high schools is what's got me on the map. And I said, so I'm going to cover the high schools tremendously well. And I'm going to do Cowboys, and then more Cowboys. And when Orr's not on, I'm probably going to be funny as hell. As best I can. And Marty Hague rocks back in his chair. And he goes, I swear to God, I'll never forget this, Mike. Marty Hague rocks back in his chair. And he goes, you know, our consultants have been telling us exactly the same thing. And I looked at him and said, you've got very good consultants. So I go home. She goes, did you get the job? I said, no, he'll call tomorrow. And she, and my own wife says, you're the cockiest son of a bitch I know. I said, no, it's not cocky. I just know, you know, next morning. In fact, that very Thursday night, I had to speak at Texas Stadium to this Boy Scout group. And they introduced me like it was like a farewell because, you know, big story all week had been I'd been fired and I'm out. Well, I know I'm going to Channel 8, but I hadn't made it official yet.
Right.
And they're doing the whole eulogy. I mean, I said, oh, man, say that at my funeral. I mean, it was like, oh, this guy's been such a great influence. He covers kids. You know, nobody covered kids like until he showed up. And, oh, you know, we're going to miss you, Dale. Oh, we're going to miss you. I'm like, man, you're not going to miss me for long. And Friday morning, I get up, the phone rings. My wife said, Marty Hague's on the phone. I got hired, and I go in. They call the guy in Alabama. The other part, so I'm looking, they had like a 10-page contract, and most of it's nonsense, as you know. And I'm looking through it, and Sidney Benton says, what are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for the salary. He said, oh, my God, we've already announced that you're coming. I said, well, I'm coming. I'm just curious what the job pays. I don't care. I'm coming. I'm unemployed, whatever. But here's the point of that long-ass story. I get my first TV job only because Dave Weber quit as I'm sitting across the desk from Mark Gutierrez. And I will promise you, as I always say, on my sainted mother's grave, it happened exactly the way I'm telling you. Had I been there 2 hours earlier, they don't consider me. I've got no college education. I've never been on TV. The only reason I got the audition is because Dave Weber quit as I'm sitting right across the desk, and Mark Gutierrez, just out of frustration, goes, yeah, you want to audition for the weekend sportscaster job? You then fast forward 5 years. If Bill Wilson and Channel 4 had decided to fire me, say, 2 weeks later, the kid from Alabama is already in the chair. Now, Terry Ford might have said, oh, man, we could have got Hanson over here. But he's not going to do that. They just signed this guy from Alabama to a contract. There's no place for me. They had Reba. They had Lundquist. They had Jerry Orr.
Right.
You know, there's no place for me. And they would have just said, well, you know, he's out of the market now. So what? We're fine. And we got to give this kid from Alabama a chance. You know, they would have never considered hiring me if only Channel 4 had waited another week or two. But they picked, whatever reason, they picked that exact day that Channel 8 had decided to hire the kid from Alabama. I mean, I think, I as a guy said to me one time when I was doing a similar interview, I'm not so humble, obviously, that I'm going to tell you that it was all luck, but it's a tremendous amount of being in the right place and being incredibly lucky. And I've never taken that for granted, which I think and I hope is one of the things that's enabled me to stick around for 40 years, is that I still love this business. I don't like it as much as I did back in the day, as you pointed out. It's different. But I think I've adapted rather well.
Yeah.
And without question, I do to this day. I work for a group of people that give me the freedom that in many cases I probably don't even deserve. And I never...
You're the great Dale Hanson. You've earned that, man.
There is a certain amount of, well, if you hang around long enough, you know, you start to earn some of it, you know. I got that Lifetime Achievement Award from this organization in D.C., and I'm like, damn, am I really this old now? I mean, but it is. It's... Yeah, I like to think that I've earned it to some extent, but I know I've just been incredibly lucky, and I'm lucky to this day. I really am. I'm lucky to this day because a lot of stations don't. Ed Bark wrote this one time, and I think he's right, that if you enjoy Dale Hanson, enjoy him now because there won't ever be another one. And it had nothing to do with about me. I mean, nobody can do that. No, hell, a lot of people can do what I do. But I'm not sure that they'll be allowed to do.
Yeah, it's just the way the game's going.
Yeah. And so people said, oh, my gosh, you must have been blown away. Nobody could replace Dale Hanson. Yeah, other than that 150 young guys coming up behind me. I mean, but will they be allowed to have the voice that separates them from the pack?
No, they won't. I'll tell you, they will not.
I tend to think you're probably right about that. Because rocking, I remember the first time I wrote, well, it doesn't matter, but I mean, when I first started getting the reactions to my commentaries and the like, and people were upset, we had people in the newsroom like, oh my God, what do we do? I'm laughing my ass off. I said, oh, this is great. I mean, thank God they're paying attention. I've never been afraid of failure. I've never been afraid to piss somebody off. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I wish everybody would go, oh my God, thank goodness now, Dale Hanson.
These are the commentaries that made their way around Ellen and everything?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah, but even a little bit more, like, you know, pick it on the Cowboys before and you know, whatever. But yeah, but certainly the Ellen one was the lightning rod one with Michael Sam and all that. But I mean, the hate mail that came with it was just, I mean, it was amazing. But I love it. I mean, I thrive on it. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it.
Sure.
And I'm not afraid to fail. I mean, obviously, I don't think you were either.
No, I mean, anybody in this business who does what you do has to know and understand that that's part of the game.
It is part of the game. I think, and again, you said this earlier, but you're absolutely right. If you're going to try and please everybody, you're just not going to please anybody.
No.
Because people say to me to this day, they say it to me. I'm telling you, if you'd stop doing those damn social commentaries and just concentrate on the highlights and the scores, I'd watch you. I said, great. And I'm serious about that. I write back and go, so what do I say to all the people who watch me because I do the commentaries and the social commentary and I make the smart aleck remarks and I poke fun at Jerry Jones? What do I say to those people? Because as soon as I do it your way, I lose them. Now, I want everybody to watch. That same general manager I was telling you about that said Marty Haig couldn't work here.
Right.
Back when the Stars were kind of just getting started at one time, and the guy called and said, man, you don't cover the Stars nearly enough. You hardly ever cover the Stars. I said, well, watch Channel 5. I said, hell, they cover the shit out of the Dallas Stars. And he got so mad, he calls the general manager. He says, I called your sportscaster to complain about his lack of coverage of hockey, and he told me to watch Channel 5. General manager called me in and said, you told him what? I said, I told him to watch Scott. Scott covers the hell out of hockey. I said, I'm trying to provide a public service. I said, he's not going to watch me. I'm not going to cover Stars. I mean, to his satisfaction, you know. Then once McDonald and I started running around, well, okay, now I'll cover the Stars a little more. No, I don't care. Turn the dial. I mean, that's why you get those little remotes now. You know?
Sure.
It's not soldered in.
No, it's why they have chocolate and vanilla.
I've never understood why people are so afraid of that. I mean, you heard it. I know you did. Oh, my God, they're sexist, or they're doing the boob jokes, or they're talking nonsense. Yeah. And I go to their ticket parties, and there's thousands of people there, and I see the ratings, and, oh, they're on a whole nother level. Gee, if only you would do it like they were trying to do at ESPN and talk about the Rangers draft picks. That's what really brings in an audience, you know. You think the Rangers can get that 17-year-old kid out of the Dominican to sign? You know, I mean, shut up. Shut up. It doesn't work.
Hey,
and that's what I think people always misunderstood, Vern in particular, about what I was doing at Channel 4. I had seen everybody trying to be Vern Lundquist. And if I do the Vern Lundquist sportscast, why would people tune away from Vern Lundquist? So you've got the guy that you've been watching for 20-plus years doing it as well as basically as it can be done in that particular style. Why would anybody go, I think I'm going to watch Vern Lundquist light?
Yeah.
They're not going to do that. I've had guys come in and they start copying me. And they try to be funny, or they try to be a smartass, they try to do a commentary. Well, that's not going to work for you. I mean, it's not. I mean, I'm sorry, it's just not. I've kind of established that I own this piece of it.
Right.
You're not.
Those guys they need to just, you know, learn how to be them. And that's one of the great things we had at the ticket. Everybody could just be who you were. Yeah.
Between Dunham and Miller and the hard line, and here comes Bob and Dan and Norm in the middle of all that nonsense.
Yeah.
You've got, whoa, gee whiz. People were being people. Now, if they wanted listen to Norm, they wanted to listen to you, they wanted to listen to Dunham and Miller, you know, fine, pick it. We'll cover all the bases. Some of it you'll like, some of it you might not like, whatever. Mike Ducey is, I think, a very good friend of mine, and I get a kick out of the fact that the two guys from Iowa, you know, You need Iowa broadcasters to control the Dallas TV scene.
Clearly.
But Ducey always, oh, I'm just a vanilla guy. I said, no, God. He is Mike Ducey. And many people, many, many people think he's the best sportscaster in town. And it's hard for me to argue with that. I mean, what he does, I mean, he's as smooth and he's got it covered. He, you know, he doesn't go out there, oh, let me be a smart ass. Let me be the guy that makes fun of Jerry Jones. Let me write about gay rights in America. No, that's not Ducey, you know. What he does is the main reason he's been there for 20 years. Although I do, and it's Ducey's line, Mike, so if you hear this, don't blame me. But he said, every time he goes back to Iowa, he sees his dad, right? He goes back to see his family. And his dad is where the guy goes, so is that that other guy from Iowa, is he still over at that other station? And Mook said, yeah, yeah, he's still there. He goes, oh, so you're still number two.
I've heard that from him before.
Yeah, yeah. But
you know, it just goes to show, Ducey is like, Ducey's like the lounge singer. You're a punk rocker. You know, they're two different things,
no,
but you know, the spectrum's big enough for all of it.
There's enough room for everybody to go around. And I tell you, you remember when Ted Dawson came in from L.A.
Oh.
And Channel 4 decided they're going to make this big splash.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, I'd never forget, the very first night he's on, he started making fun of Chuck Huff. Calls Charlie Huff Chuck and makes fun of, you know, he had like a bad outing or something. And I'm saying, oh, good. And everybody went, oh, gosh, he's done. I said, you know, here's an L.A. guy who's got this big persona and thinks he's really hot stuff. And he's making fun of one of the most popular Rangers ever, at least in my opinion. As everybody always said, if you're ever looking for Hanson, just find Charlie Huff because he's sitting right on his hip, you know, but... I said, you don't come into a market brand new and start calling Charlie Huff Chuck and making fun of Charlie. I mean, you just don't. And people have tried it a lot over the years. I mean, I've had several of them try it. And again, it's not that somebody can't do it, but if you want smartass, if you want people that poke fun at Jerry Jones, if you want people who write social commentaries, why would you then say, okay, I don't like Dale, so I'll watch somebody else do it? No, they're not going to do that.
No.
But they do, and a lot of them do say, well, man, I don't like any of that. I'm going to watch Ducey. I mean, Ducey's rock solid. Ducey does good stuff. He's entertaining. He's got all the greats. Well, yeah, I get that. Or I'm going to watch Nui for, you know, whatever. Bill Jones now, Babe Laufenberg before, whatever.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a different style to all of this stuff. I've never, ever thought that I was going to get all the pie. I just want the biggest slice. And,
you got it.
And, yeah, I mean,
you got
for
it.
A while I have, you know. I mean,
all right, I got one more thing for you.
Yep.
How long you got?
I just signed recently to do 2 more years. And I think and hope that I'll do those 2 years. And that would give me 40 years at Channel 8. But I'm kind of this anal numbers kind of a guy. I love the concept of 40 years at Channel 8. But then I've also got those other 2.5 years at Channel 4. So actually we're kind of stuck like 42 and a half.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you need a nice round number in there somewhere.
Yeah, I love, if I quit now, it would have been 40 years in Dallas television. Right? If I quit now. August of 1980 is when I came to Dallas. So it would have been 40 years. I just passed 40 years a couple months ago. And I did think about it at the time. And But our general manager, Brad Ramsey, called me, you know, back in, what was that, June or July, and here we are, and I was on a one-year deal. He goes, what do you want? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you know? And I'm like, well, that's more up in your wheelhouse than mine. He goes, no, pick whatever you want. You stay as long as you want. As long as you're up for it, as long as you're, but, you know, what I'm, in all seriousness, Mike, what I'm most concerned about, and I'll tell you this, because I just did it last night. I said, Clayton Kershaw pitches game one tonight against Atlanta. Yippee. And, oh, I mean, there's a lot of excuses for it. I mean, I was slamming this in the middle of the Cowboys game, and I'm trying to get ready for the A hit, and I'm just banging it.
Yeah.
And I just had this brain lock of Atlanta, Atlanta, Atlanta. And I said it on the air. I didn't catch it. My producer didn't catch it. Luckily, the producer before it aired caught it, and did some editing magic and whatever. But I've got about five people, Sean Hamilton, my wife, some friends of mine. My biggest fear is that I stay too long. I mean, believe it or not, my single biggest fear is that I stay too long. And as you well know, and I said this to you, for me, it's going to be incredibly hard to walk away. Because I've already, I told Barry Horn this one time. I've written about half of my so-called farewell speech. I've got about half of it kind of blocked out, whatever. And because to me, the next big step is the one step that I just do not want to take, where I step into the box. What can happen in my life, you know, podcast, maybe. I think what I hope
it's
to do.
It's not such a bad thing.
No, not at all. But I think what I really hope to do is I'm going to do this every day. It's a day-by-day basis, actually. But I would like to get on the speaking circuit. And I've had people talking to me about it. I would like to be able to go out and speak on behalf of candidates that I support that I'm not allowed to now. I would like to speak at seminars and you know, I mean, hey, there's some money in it, but I'm not. I mean, I kind of just want to use my so-called voice for whatever.
Yeah.
And, but I've said this to me, it's like great athletes. You know, that Troy Aikman said to me one time, he was like his rookie year. So he's like, what, 21, 22 years old. And we're playing golf. I never forget. We're on the second tee at Trophy Club. And one of the guys in our group said, Troy, how long are you going to looking forward to playing this game? What, you know, what's the plan? He goes, Dale, he looked at me and said, I won't play when I'm 30. He said, before I turn 30, I'm walking away. And I just laughed like hell. I said, I've only known you for like 6 months, and there's not a day in hell you're walking away at 30. I said, they're going to have to come cut the jersey off you. He goes through, like three back operations. He's hobbling around like crazy. He's now 34, closing in on 35, retires from the Cowboys, and then talks to the Chargers about going to play for them. He doesn't want to quit. How many baseball players have we watched over the years? I mean, to me, the biggest crime of all was Willie Mays. You know, stumbling as he rounded first base. Yeah. And balls are dropped, whatever.
Yeah, but they just can't give it up, man.
Because it is. It and this is the point, even in my little time, where it's everything I am. It's who,
yes,
I am.
Yes.
And once that light gets turned off, most of, like Troy, okay, went on to Brian. I guarantee you, Troy would play tomorrow if he thought there was a team that would. I think he'd play tomorrow.
Yeah.
And again, the great ones do. I mean, but I don't want to be that guy that's out there hitting 186. And stumbles as he rounds first base, you know. Now, does that really change the memory of you know? Well, probably not. But
I don't know, man. It's the last thing they see.
It's the last. I mean, you know, here's Michael Jordan out there playing for the Washington Wizards, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, yeah, it's ugly, but you know, you get past that for the most part.
Yeah, it's just a minor footnote, but still, I could have done without seeing that.
Oh, guys, you know? Yes. Oh, I didn't want to see it.
And
no, I don't want
the
to
Willie
see it,
Mays, you know, thing, man, that was just tragic.
Oh, beyond tragic. Warren Spahn did the same thing.
Yeah.
Warren Spahn. I mean, I as a kid, I just loved watching Warren Spahn pitch. And what? Now he's 45 and he's still hanging out, trying to sign on with a minor league team. But again, the point is, and I really do believe this, it's just hard to accept the fact that everything you thought you were, everything that you wanted to be, is now over. It's over. I mean, Rush Limbaugh even said this the other day. You know, now he's got, you know, diagnosed, apparently relatively short lifespan remaining. And he goes, it's just hard to realize that, you know, I'm on a death sentence now. Well, you know, we all are, obviously. But I think Rush Limbaugh is more concerned about walking away from the power that he has behind the microphone than he is of dying from cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all going to die. And yet, when that day comes for me, and it's not that far away, obviously, but walking away and being in retirement, although it bothers my wife more than anything else. She said, hell, you'll never get out of your chair, and you'll just, you know, whatever. And I'm like, nah, whatever. But I'll never shave. I'll never get another haircut. I'm going to turn into a miniature version of Don Nelson, you know. And I joke, I've got a little lung thing going on right now. My doctor says I can't smoke cigars. And I said, well, he said, you can't ever smoke again. I said, oh, man. I said, so I plan on retiring. I want to go back and smoke that marijuana again when I retire. He goes, oh, no, you can't. I'm like, and he goes, you know there's edibles, right? Or chewables, whatever they call them, you know, whatever. I said, no, that's not the same thing.
I guess that's going to eliminate the trip to Maui to see Nelly.
Yeah, right. No, I'm not going to do that either now. So, but it's just, you know, if and when, and that day soon comes, I think I'm going to be more bothered, if this makes any sense, I'm going to be more bothered by the fact that everything I am, everything I've enjoyed being, is now over. That's the problem. Not the fact that I've gotten older and I'm going to die someday. I mean, I've pretty much come to grips with that for the most part. But I just, as I said to, you can't have a World Series and I'm not there. You can't go to Cowboys training camp and I'm not holding court in the bar that night while we're arguing about that new rookie. You can't do that. I mean, it's me. How can you? And it's kind of the same thing I say to my buddies. Like, well, once I do die, well, hell, you can't go hang out in a bar again. I'm the guy that picks up the tab for the most part. Hell, how are you guys going to cover the tab? You know, so I've signed for 2 more years. I think, you know, for the most part, I'll do that 2 years. I've got a very nice setup. I got great people around me. I still enjoy it. I mean, that's the bottom line. I don't enjoy it the same way that I used to, but I still. When that camera comes on, it's just like a drug to me. I mean, I'm sorry. Even my wife says it all the time. She goes, "My God, you walk around the house and you bitch and you're madder than hell. Why didn't I take tonight off? And oh, that damn NBA game's lasting till 11:45 or some." And as soon as that light goes on, there can't be a drug more powerful than that.
Everything goes away.
And when that feeling, if that feeling should ever leave me, then I'll know it's time to walk away. But when I write a commentary, when I've got something that I think's funny or clever or smart, Alec, and I know that people are going to sit up and like, oh, man, did he just say that? There's nothing better than that. There just isn't. And so, you know, we'll do the 2-year contract and see where it goes.
See what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't thank you enough, man.
Oh, man, it's been great.
Really enjoyed this today. I hope we can do it again sometime if you're down with it.
I'd be happy to do it. As my wife said to me when I left the house today, she goes, oh, so you're going to spend an hour plus talking about you. Well, it is your favorite subject.
He is the great Dale Hansen, and this has been Square One, thanks to Vocal for allowing us to use their facility. And again, if you're in the podcast game, maybe your facilities aren't up to speed, then you need to look into Vocal. Go to vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com. And check it out. Believe you'll like what you see. This has been Square One. I am Mike Reiner. Thank you for listening.